All right, welcome. This is episode 633 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be addressing a rapid review for the USMLE Step 2CK / Step 3 exams. And this is going to be series 132. A lot of actually pretty high yield things I'm going to be discussing today. Biostatistics, just a few ideas I've kind of had in my head. So I kind of figured today will be a good day to hit those, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient works as an air traffic controller. And then you're told that the patient, the patient's an air traffic controller. And then you're told that the patient at his place of work, because of excessive noise exposure, he's enrolled in a hearing conservation program that involves annual audiometry. And then they ask you, these actions taken by the patient's employer most likely represents which of the following levels of prevention? I'd really hope you're picking the answer that says secondary prevention. I'd really hope you're picking the answer that says what? Secondary prevention. The USMLEs, they love to do stuff like this, right? And this is something that basically falls under the purview of social sciences and ethics, right? There's a reason why that material, you know, together with biostatistics, it ends up being about 15% of the exams, right? So if you're interested in that material, I do have a class coming up this week. Actually, on Wednesday, I have a social sciences and ethics class taking place on Wednesday. You know, QI, all those things, we cover that in that class, a five-hour class, cover like almost like 300 scenarios. And then on Tuesday, which is basically tomorrow, I have a four-hour biostatistics class. The class I have today, this evening, is the test-taking strategies class. But let's continue with that, right? So basically, like, this person is in a career, is in a job where they have excessive exposure to noise, right? When you have a lot of exposure to noise, that can cause hearing loss, right? That can typically gonna cause a sensory neural hearing loss. And let me ask you this, will this sensory neural hearing loss in this patient be unilateral or bilateral if they were to have it? It's gonna be bilateral, right? It's gonna be bilateral. That's pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? So if the person is in a hearing conservation program and we're trying to screen them for hearing loss, that screening is going to be secondary prevention, right? Remember, secondary prevention is when you screen to catch disease early, to figure out if a person has a disease earlier or not, right? But what if they give you a question and they tell you that, you know, the employer decides to institute the use of earplugs and earmuffs, and the patient has no history of hearing loss on audiometry, then that'll be an example of primary prevention, right? You're literally trying to prevent them from developing hearing loss in the first place, right? You're literally trying to prevent them from developing hearing loss in the first place, right? But what if they give you a scenario and the person has already developed some mild hearing loss, and then in the hearing conservation program, you institute that, hey, this person should have earmuffs and earplugs, that they should be fit tested for it and they should use it regularly. Then in that circumstance, that's going to be an example of tertiary prevention. We already know that you have the pathology. Now we're just trying to minimize it. We're trying to prevent it from worsening. We're trying to prevent it from getting worse, right? So guys, it's very high yield to know these things for exams, right? Because they like to do these blended questions where they'll give you a scenario, and really depends on the scenario that then tells you the level of prevention, right? So you have to analyze the context of the situation that they're giving to you on your exams, right? So like, for example, if you're a person that is a resident and you work at a, you know, you're working an ICU and you're wearing an N95 mask, again, that's primary prevention. Right, we're trying to prevent you from getting COVID-19 or TB or measles or whatever, right? Or, you know, from people that are, you know, kind of infected. All right. So what if they give you a question about a patient? So second vignette today, right? So they give you a question about a patient that was started on semaglutide 3 months ago. And the patient, upon initiation of therapy, the person's BMI was 35. But that now this person's BMI is 29. The person comes for follow-up, right? And during the visits with the physician, during the patient-physician encounter, the patient complains of, you know, having like a thinning. The person is complaining of his hair no longer looks uniform. That's his chief complaints to the physician, right? And then they ask you which of the following is the most likely diagnosis. The thing you're going to be picking on your exams, I would really hope, is a telogen effluvium. Telogen, T-E-L-O-G-E-N, effluvium, E-F-F-L-U-V. IUM, telogen effluvium, or telogen effluvium, right? Depending on where you're from, right? But again, they like to, again, blend things. See, the USMLEs these days, they're not very big on linear questions. They're very big on integrations, right? The goal of your exam is for them to integrate a question to you and for you to figure out that integration and picking your answer, right? So this person has telogen effluvium, and telogen effluvium Basically, it's just a loss of hair, right? And you just notice over a very short time period, the person just loses a ton of hair, and it's like a diffuse hair loss. It's not like concentrated in one region of the scalp, right? They have like this just acute diffuse hair loss, right? And typically, we're going to see this when the body is like shocked. What do I mean by when the body is shocked? Well, if you lose a lot of weight very quickly, that can cause that problem. They can also give you the same thing in a person that is pregnant or a person that, you know, was just, you know, has been living with cancer for a bit, right? Or the person just underwent like very big surgery or had a myocardial infarction or something like that, right? Or the person had like very severe like mental trauma, you know, let's say the person was raped or whatever, right? That puts the body under very intense amounts of stress, right? When you see people that have recently undergone very intense levels of stress, and you notice that they have hair loss, right? Just diffuse hair loss. Then in that circumstance, I really want you to think of a person having telogen effluvium, right? So typically, you're going to notice that your hair is just going to thin out, right? So the person typically on the USMLE is the classic vignette will be the person saying that his hair no longer looks uniform and that he has noticed that his hair looks patchy, right? When you see something like that, that's telogen effluvium, right? That's telogen effluvium. And the thing is, sometimes our friends at the MBMEs, again, because they love prognosis, I mean, this is something I address a lot in my classes. I tell people that, hey, prognosis, do not ignore it for your exams, right? But they can ask you which of the following is the most likely outcome of this patient's presentation. Well, I'd hope that you're going to say like self-limited, right? Or pick the answer that says eventual resolution, right? The thing is, telogen effluvium is going to resolve, right? Many times once that stressor goes away or when the body gets used to that stressor, the person is going to grow their hair back. The person is literally going to grow their hair back, right? Again, it's pretty high yield to know that for your exams, right? So these people, their scalp, their hair shafts are completely fine, right? But they'll lose all that hair. Sometimes it can take up to a year for the hair to come back, but it will come back, right? So just reassure those people, right? So again, classic vignette on your exams is to blend it with a GLP-1 agonist, right? Because again, remember, these GLP-1 agonists like semaglutide or tirzepatide or liraglutide or exenatide, right? They are very, very good at causing fairly rapid weight loss, right? Especially if you're basically like taking them and doing the things, right? Like you're doing strength training, you're doing some cardio, you know, you're counting your calories, you know, stuff like that. All right, now let's go ahead and continue here. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is brought to the, you know, that this person has a history of hepatitis C infection, right? And that over the last 3 months, his wife has noticed a change in behavior. You know, notice a change in behavior, that he has been having a lot of mood swings and he has been sometimes having these very angry outbursts, right? And then we're told that this patient on physical exam has a white exudate in his oral cavity, right? And we're told that the patient has like mild weakness in his bilateral lower extremities. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about on your exams? What should you be thinking about on your exams? Well, I'd really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is hand. No, I don't mean your real hands. What exactly do I mean? I mean HIV-associated neurocognitive disorder. HIV-associated neurocognitive disorder, right? So you may be like, oh, come on, Divine, like this is kind of mean. How do you expect me to have figured out that this person has HIV? Well, I gave you too many clues. I was actually a little too nice with this question, right? Like literally, this person has a history of hep C. You know, IV drug use, right? That's a way to get HIV. Okay, person has a history of hep C. What other clue did I give? Okay, I gave that, this person has a white exudate on the oral cavity. This person has oral candidiasis, right? That's pretty classic in people that have HIV, right? Again, please, they're not going to give you every single thing known to mankind for you to properly answer a question. No. They literally will not give you every single thing known to mankind, right? So just be careful about that. They may not necessarily give you every single thing known to mankind. Please keep that at the back of your mind as you prepare for your exams, right? So this person has HIV-associated neurocognitive disease, right? So how's this going to present on your exams? Well, this is typically going to present in a person that is immunocompromised, right? And it's going to be a person that is probably not on antiretroviral therapy. I can almost promise you, the person will almost certainly not be on antiretroviral therapy. Person will not be on antiretroviral therapy, right? So their HIV will be poorly controlled, right? It will be poorly controlled. Many times their CD4 count is going to be under 200 on the USMLE exams, right? It's going to be very, very low. And you're going to notice that they're going to, there's a reason it's called a neurocognitive disorder, right? There's literally a reason why it's called neurocognitive disorder, right? So they're going to have like issues with cognition. They're going to have like these neuropsych symptoms. You're going to notice that they have, they're beginning to have like signs of like dementia, right? In fact, before they used to call this HIV dementia, but again, these days, the more official term is HIV associated neurocognitive disease, right? So they'll have like mood problems, they'll have behavioral problems, they may have these angry outbursts, they may have these dementive symptoms, right? Again, if you see something like that, and I can almost promise you, they're going to try to confuse you with Alzheimer's on your exams. Do not pick Alzheimer's, right? If you see a person that has demented style symptoms and their CD4 count is very low, it's hand they have. They don't have Alzheimer's disease, right? They don't have Alzheimer's disease. And then sometimes on the exams, they will ask which of the following represents the greatest risk factor, right? Or which of the following patient specific risk factors is the biggest risk factor for this problem in this patient? Well, I'd hope you're picking the answer that talks about like a low CD4 count, right? If the person's CD4 count is low, then that's going to really, really increase their risk. In fact, let me show you how the USMLEs are going to try to put you in trouble with this kind of prognostic factor or risk factor question, right? So say, for example, they give you a person that has hand and they're in their 30s and the person has a low CD4 count, right? If you see something like that, I will strongly encourage you to pick the answer that talks about the low CD4 count, right? I will strongly encourage you to pick the answer that talks about the person's low CD4 count, right? Low CD4 count in that situation will be a bigger risk factor. Okay, don't get me wrong, as you get older and you have hand, the worse your prognosis. But the thing is, typically, like the lower your CD4 count, the more opportunity HIV has to replicate in your brain. And if you can replicate in your brain, it's going to cause problems. Again, remember, HIV can mess up your brain matter. It can mess up your microglia, right? It can cause a lot of problems, right? This is why once a person is diagnosed with HIV, go ahead and put them on antiretroviral therapy. You know, sometimes we call that highly active antiretroviral therapy. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 32-year-old female and that for, you know, she has a history of like a shortness of breath and dry cough, right? And that for the last 24 hours, she has been having like very significant eye pain, very, very significant eye pain, right? Very significant pain in her left eye. Very significant pain in her left eye, and she tells you that she has had a lot of tearing and the eye looks very red on physical exam. And then you're told that visual acuity is, so this is the right eye, okay? She has all these problems in the right eye. And they tell you that visual acuity is 20 over 40 in the left eye and 20 over 80 in the right eye, right? And they then tell you that, you know, this, you know, patient has required corticosteroid therapy in the past for her chronic cough and shortness of breath, right? If you see this, what's going to be your most likely diagnosis here? I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this looks like anterior uveitis, anterior uveitis. You're like, wait, what? Divine, how did you arrive at this? Well, let me explain how I arrived at this, right? So let me ask you this. First things first, what systemic disease does this patient have? Well, this person has sarcoidosis, right? Like, think about it, a woman that is relatively young, right? And not just relatively young, she has a history of like dry cough, shortness of breath, right? And she has required steroid therapy in the past. Let me ask you this, how do you think sarcoidosis is treated? I hope you're saying steroids, right? So this person probably has a sarcoidosis, right? This person probably has a sarcoidosis. So whenever you see a person that has sarcoidosis and then they have like eye pain, they have eye inflammation, I will strongly encourage you to think about anterior uveitis on your exams. I strongly encourage you to think about anterior uveitis on your exams, right? So typically, the way this is going to present is going to be an acute presentation, right? And the person is going to have like very bad visual acuity. The person is going to have redness of the eye. They're going to have tearing. They're going to have meiosis. So they're going to have pupillary constriction, right? When you see something like that, think about anterior uveitis, okay? And the thing is, you know, there are many different ways they can test this on the exams. I decided to test it in the context of sarcoidosis for this question. But there are many other ways they can test this exact same thing, right? They can test it in a person that has ulcerative colitis. They can test it in a person that has Crohn's disease. They can test it in a person that has any of the HLA-B27 spondyloarthropathies, right? Like, you know, ankylosing spondylitis, psoriatic arthritis, right? Or reactive arthritis. Those people can certainly have anterior uveitis, right? And then another way they can also test this, they can test it in the context of a person that has like an infection, right? Anterior uveitis can literally arise from an infective process. It can literally arise from an infective process, right? Now, the thing is, sometimes on the USMLEs, actually, there are two other ways besides what I've said that they can use to try to screw you over with anterior uveitis on your exams. So what are the ways they can try to screw you over? Let me kind of walk you through these so that you're not gimped on your exams, right? So first thing they can do is they can literally give you an anterior uveitis question. Right? They can literally give you an anterior uveitis question, right? And then ask, which of the following represents the most likely etiology of this patient's presentation? And of course, they're not going to tell you the person has anterior uveitis. They'll expect you to decipher that the person has anterior uveitis. And then they will ask you which of the following represents the most likely etiology of this patient's presentation, right? And then they will put an answer that says sarcoidosis. They'll put an answer that says inflammatory bowel disease. They'll put an answer that talks about the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? They'll put an answer that says infection. They'll put an answer that says idiopathic. If you see these things, then you want to go ahead and pick the answer that says idiopathic, right? The most common cause, very high yield, the most common cause of anterior uveitis is an idiopathic, it just arises idiopathically. We don't know what causes it, right? Although some people can also have it from just trauma, right? But typically it's going to be idiopathic on your exams. And another disorder that you should know, and they're going to obviously put this in a pediatric patient or a teenager on your exams, is going to be a person that has oligoarticular juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, right? Remember, oligoarticular JRA has a very, very strong association with anterior uveitis. In fact, this is precisely why when a person has oligoarticular JRA, those people are subjected to annual eye exams, annual slit lamp eye exams, annual slit lamp eye exams. Pretty high yield to know that stuff for your test. Okay, now what is the second way they can try to screw you over with anterior uveitis on your exams? Again, the USMLEs, they're not stupid. They've realized that most people have memorized anterior uveitis, right? So they know many of you have memorized that term, right? So what is one way they create new questions from the same concept? Is to literally just switch up the name. So what other name may you see on your exams for anterior uveitis? Well, they may call it iritis. 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 I-R-I-T-I-S. Or they may call it iridocyclitis. Iridocyclitis, right? So what are two other names for anterior uveitis on your exams? Think of iritis and think of iridocyclitis, right? I-R-I-D-O-C-Y-C-L-I-T-I-S, iridocyclitis. Very high yield to know those for your exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, this is just a factoid thing I just want to go over. Just one of these simple things. I've probably said this in other podcasts, right? But remember, if you do the pooled cohort calculations, what is the threshold that makes us say, okay, let's go ahead and put you on a statin? I'd hope you're saying divine 7.5%, right? If your risk, if your 10-year ASCVD risk is more than 7.5%, over the next 10 years, then we're going to go ahead and put you on a statin. All right, let's maybe hit a few things that are biostatistics related as we begin to wrap up this podcast, right? So what if they give you a question about, it's a confounding question. Again, if you're kind of confused on confounding, if confounding is confounding you, you should go and listen to my confounding podcast. I literally have a podcast on confounding and I have a separate podcast on effect modification, right? So if you get a question about confounding and then they tell you that, control for this factor, the researchers decide to do perform a stratification. And then a classic thing they'll ask you is, this mode of controlling for the confounder will most likely be done in what phase of the research study? Well, I'd really hope you're saying that if the person did stratification, is something that is done in the analysis phase of the person's research study, right? This is just one of these strange things that almost no research talks about, but is very, very high yield to know for the USMLE exams, right? And what do they do? They know that you have memorized. Let me tell you something, guys, right? Before I introduce this concept, because it's going to make more sense to you, make it more meaningful. The thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, they realize that a lot of people use Anki these days. They recognize that a lot of people just blindly, blatantly, flagrantly memorize things without any form or degree of understanding, right? So these days, the stuff you know, yes, you still need that foundation, but they will extend beyond it a little bit just to see if you can think beyond just the basic stuff you've memorized from some Anking or Anquin or whatever deck that you're memorizing. Again, there's nothing wrong about using Anki. Just make sure you actually understand what you're memorizing, right? So the thing is, if you're doing stratification to control for confounding, it's going to be done at the analysis phase of the study, right? It's literally going to be done at the analysis phase of the study. That's when you do stratification. You don't stratify people before the study has started, right? But what if the mode that you use, what if the method that you use to control for confounding is randomization, right? Because remember, you can use randomization. By randomizing, you pretty much spread out the confounder equally between your two groups, your experimental group and your control group. Well, that's done during the selection phase of the study, right? So make sure you know what can be done during the selection phase of the study, that's randomization, versus during the analysis phase of the study, that's stratification. This concept is actually pretty simple, but again, you can just see people kind of get into trouble with this, right? And again, another thing I want to discuss with biostatistics, right, is again, What kind of information can you get from a cross-sectional study? Literally, what kind of information can you get from a cross-sectional study? Well, the key thing to know is that it can give you prevalence information, right? They can try to trick you on your exams and put an answer that says that you can get incidence or whatever. You cannot get incidence information from a cross-sectional study, right? A cross-sectional study is literally a point-in-time study, right? You literally get a snapshot. So because you're studying people at one point in time, you cannot see new cases developing. You want to see new cases developing, then you have to use something like a cohort study, for example, because that's a longitudinal study. Okay, so remember, a cross-sectional study is a snapshot study. It's a point-in-time study. But a cohort study, on the other hand, is a longitudinal study. It's a longitudinal study. Again, very high yield to know those things for your exams, right? So a cohort study can give you prevalence and incidence information, but a cross-sectional study can only give you prevalence information, All right. Now, just real quick run through to wrap this podcast up. I just want to run through 10 high-yield drugs to know for your exams and the way it's going to be tested on your exams, right? This is just going to be literally a quick run through, right? Propranolol, nidolol, think of those. You can use those non-selective beta blockers to manage esophageal, as prophylaxis for esophageal varices, right? So as prophylaxis, right? We don't want you having esophageal varices. You give them chronically. You take it regularly so you don't have a bleeding varices. Okay, let's talk about propranolol. That's number two. Propranolol is also used on the USMLE exams for the management of thyroid storm. Why? Because it inhibits that peripheral 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3. All right, next drug we're going to talk about, sildenafil. What is sildenafil used for on the USMLE exams? It's used for two purposes. Number one, it can be used for the management of erectile dysfunction, right? It can be used for the management of erectile dysfunction because it works at the level of the copper cavernosa. Remember, it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, so it's going to increase your levels of cyclic GMP. That's going to cause smooth muscle relaxation, so your penis is going to be engorged with blood, right? And then it's also used for pulmonary hypertension. It's also used for pulmonary hypertension, because it can cause pulmonary vessel dilation. And remember, be careful about combining sildenafil with a nitrate or another powerful vasodilator, like an alpha-1 blocker, right? Or even something that may not be an alpha-1 blocker, but indirectly has alpha-1 effects, like a tricyclic antidepressant, right? Those things, you combine them with a sildenafil, that can cause a big-time drop in blood pressure and cause orthostatic hypotension, right? So they can give you about a question about a person that has erectile dysfunction, and then the person is placed on a new drug for BPH, and then the person has like all these syncopal or presyncopal episodes. Well, basically what happened is you combine the person's alpha-1 blocker with the sildenafil that they're taking. All right, next drug we're going to talk about, dorzolamide, right? Dorzolamide. What will dorzolamide be used for in the USMLE exams? Well, dorzolamide, or its close cousin acetazolamide, they're carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, right? So what do we use them for? Well, we use them for things like mounting sickness, right? We can certainly use them for mounting sickness on the USMLE exams, right? And they can also use for the management of chronic glaucoma, right? They can you can use them to manage open angle glaucoma, right? Because by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase, you're going to decrease the production of aqueous humor. All right, let's go to another drug. So what if they give you a question on your exams about denosumab? Well, remember, denosumab is a rank ligand inhibitor, right? Remember, your osteoblasts, they express the RANK ligand that then binds to the RANK receptor on osteoclasts to activate those osteoclasts, right? So denosumab is a monoclonal antibody against RANK ligand. It binds to RANK ligand. And when you bind to RANK ligand, you're going to prevent interaction with the RANK receptor. And if that happens, your osteoclasts will not be activated and you're not going to throw up your bone. So what do we use denosumab for? We use denosumab for the management of hypercalcemia of malignancy. Remember, you can also use bisphosphonates for that purpose. Okay, drug number six that we're going to talk about is teriparatide, T-E-R-I-P-A-R-A-T-I-D-E. What is teriparatide? How does it work? Well, it's a PTH analog. And you give it intermittently. Remember, PTH works differently. Parathyroid hormone works differently depending on if you give it intermittently or if you did give it constantly. If you give it constantly, osteoclasts are going to be activated, you're going to resorb your bone. But if you give it intermittently, kind of like GnRH, kind of like Luprolide, you give it intermittently, that's going to cause bone buildup. So we occasionally use it for the management of osteoporosis. We occasionally use it for the management of osteoporosis, right? So, but the thing is, you cannot give it for more than 2 years because think about it, you're literally giving a stimulating factor for bone that can increase the person's risk of osteosarcoma. All right, now drug number seven, let's talk about bisphosphonates. What do we use bisphosphonates for on the USMLE exams? Well, we use bisphosphonates for the management of osteoporosis, right? That's pretty high yield to know for your exams. We also use them to manage hypercalcemia of malignancy. That's also pretty high yield to know for your exams. And we can also use them to manage Paget's disease of the bone. bone. We can also use them to manage what? Paget's disease of the bone. That's pretty high yield to know for the purposes of your test. Okay, now drug number 8, amiloride or triamterin. What do we use amiloride or triamterin for? Well, those are potassium sparing diuretics, right? But typically on the USMLE exams, they are rarely used for their antihypertensive purposes. We typically use them in one of two variations on the exams. Well, one is to prevent the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus that is caused by lithium. Because remember, how does lithium cause nephrogenic DI? Well, if you go to the principal cell of the collecting duct, lithium enters through the ENaC channel, right, on the urine side of the principal cell of the collecting duct, and then it goes and disrupts the V2 receptor signaling cascade, right? So that prevents the insertion of aquaporin channels on the urine side of your tubules to go ahead and reabsorb water, right? So you can prevent lithium from doing those dirty deeds by literally blocking that ENaC channel with potassium-sparing diuretics like amiloride or triamterin. They literally work by blocking the ENaC channel. Now, those diuretics, also remember they are potassium-sparing diuretics. So since they are potassium-sparing diuretics, if a person is taking another drug for the management of their high blood pressure, and those people have hypokalemia as a side effect of that drug, and, you know, the person is having like some mild symptoms, right? One way you can actually just fix that hypokalemia problem is to just give them a potassium sparing diuretic like amiloride or triamterin, right? It's going to help with even better blood pressure control. But because they are potassium sparing diuretics, they cause a hyperkalemia. You can use that to counterbalance the hypokalemia that the other diuretic that they're taking is causing, like a thiazide diuretic, for example. All right, now drug number 9. That I'm going to talk about is dobutamine, right? So dobutamine, remember, it's a beta 1 agonist. It's a positive inotrope, right? We can use it for cardiogenic shock, right? We can use it for cardiogenic shock because, remember, it's going to stimulate beta 1 receptors. And if you stimulate beta 1 receptors, that's going to increase your cardiac output, your cardiac contractility, right? So your heart rate, your stroke volume is going to go up, right? And one thing that they can test on the USMLE exams with regards to dobutamine is they can ask you which of the following will be most likely observed, 12 hours after a person is given a bolus of dobutamine, in terms of GFR. Remember, the GFR is going to rise and creatinine is going to fall, right? Well, why is that? Well, the thing is, again, it's a positive inotrope, right? So it's going to basically stimulate the heart. As you stimulate the heart, right, you're not going to be collecting fluid in your body. That fluid, you're able to push it forward. You'll be able to have forward flow to your kidneys. And once it gets to the kidneys, right, because you're sending more blood to the kidneys, you're delivering more blood through the afferent arteriole, right, you're going to send more blood to the glomerular capillaries. If more blood goes to the glomerular capillaries, you're going to have an increase in hydrostatic pressure within those glomerular capillaries. If that happens, you're going to have more fluid extravasation. You're going to have more filtration. So your GFR is going to rise, and that's going to bring your creatinine down. All right, and that's, you're also going to be able to make urine, and that's going to help you get rid of all that excess volume. That's one of the reasons why we like to use dobutamine when people have a cardiogenic shock. All right, now the final drug I am going to talk about here today is going to be amlodipine, right? So amlodipine, what context do they use it for in the USMLE exams? Well, they use it in the context of the fact that it's a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? Amlodipine is a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. So how exactly does it work? Well, the way it works is that it is an arteriolar dilator. It's an arteriolar dilator. So because it dilates arterioles, right, it's very, very good for managing blood pressure. It literally reduces your systemic vascular resistance, right? If you reduce systemic vascular resistance, you're going to lower a person's blood pressure. But what is one big side effect with amlodipine? Well, it's going to be that peripheral edema. Again, go back to the mechanism of action. It dilates arterioles, right? When you dilate arterioles, you're going to send more blood to the vessels that are next in the vascular tree. That's going to be your capillaries. If you send more blood to your capillaries because you're dilating arterioles, you're going to increase the hydrostatic pressure within those systemic capillaries. When you increase those hydrostatic pressures, you're going to have more fluid extravasation. As you have more fluid extravasation, that's going to literally cause you to have peripheral edema. Now, how can you fix that peripheral edema? Well, you can give an ACE inhibitor. Because again, Divine, why would ACE inhibitors work for this purpose? Well, easy. Look at the next vessel in the vascular tree, right? Remember, after arterioles, we have capillaries. After capillaries, we have venules. Well, what do ACE inhibitors do to venules? ACE inhibitors dilate the post-capillary venules. They literally dilate those post-capillary venules. If you dilate those venules, then you're going to be pulling blood away from those systemic capillaries. If you remove blood from those systemic capillaries, you're going to reduce the hydrostatic pressure within those systemic capillaries, and that's going to basically shut down that peripheral edema. All right, so that's it. Again, if you love the way I teach, you're going to love my classes, right? I love to, and it's not like some TA that teaches my classes. It's literally me that teaches my classes. So if you love the way I teach, you'll love my classes. You'll love one-on-one tutoring with me, right? I have classes that literally start this evening. I have a test taking strategies class. It's 2.5 hours long. It's for step 1, 2, 3. It's from like 7:45. It starts at 7:45 p.m. Eastern. And it's over Zoom. And then tomorrow, Tuesday, I have a 4-hour biostatistics class. Starts at 5:45 p.m. Eastern time. And then, So the class tonight starts at 7:45 p.m. Eastern. The class tomorrow starts at 6:45 p.m. Eastern, right? And then on Wednesday, I have a 5-hour social sciences, quality improvement, healthcare systems, ethics class. It's a 5-hour class. The thing is that that class has gotten bigger over time because there's just so much of that material covered on the USMLEs. It's almost like an arms race to make sure we're keeping up with them, which I really make very strict efforts to do. It's a 5-hour class. These first three classes I mentioned, they're for step 1 to step 3. And then on Thursday, God willing, I have a 3-hour last minute review. It's for step 2 and step 3. And then on starting on Saturday, and you know, basically counting Saturday and the 5 days after that, I have the 20-hour step 2, step 3 class, right? And then in June, I have the 50-hour step 2, step 3 class, the 500 multiple choice question class. And it's not just 500 multiple choice questions. We have a lot more stuff that happens in that class. The people that have taken that class, the alumni of that class, they've done extremely well on the exams. Literally, extremely well on the exams. In fact, I've had somebody that took the class, right? The class is a 2-week class. And again, there's limited spots for that. It's a 2-week class. The person like took the first week of the class and went and took their real exam. It just happened to have to take their real exam. I think it was like their... I think it was like step 2 or something like that. The person got like in the 250s, just from like half the course. Obviously, the person came back to take the remaining 5 days because I think they had like a complex exam or whatever that they also had to take, right? But that class is very, very good. It is extremely high yield. Just imagine for 50 hours, you're working through content, very comprehensive coverage of content. And then you're working through like test taking strategies out the wazoo. Like literally, you'll be like an extremely confident and extremely good test taker after that class. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and complex exams. I also help with ERAS applications, personal statements, mock interviews, even discussing rank lists with people. I do all those things with people. And then I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower. So every week I post like 1 or 2 podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. Divineinterventionlifelessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 634. So have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.